Okay, so thanks very much. In fact, what I wanted to tell you about, this talk really wanted to get into the issue of where variation comes from inside cells. In this case, I'm going to talk mostly about variation in gene expression, which is really important for the operation of genetic circuits. And the way, in fact, we got into this subject was by making some of our own genetic circuits and realizing that the operation inside cells was incredibly variable, and we want to understand why. So in the first part of the talk, I'm just going to discuss some experiments we did to really pin down where variation was coming from inside cells. And in the second half, I want to talk about some things we've been doing more recently to look at the dynamics in gene regulation, how things look over time when you follow them over time. So here's one motivation for this. And this is a movie of Bacillus subtilis cells. This is a soil bacteria. And here they are growing and dividing. And you'll notice that all of a sudden, a few turn into spores at different locations in the movie. And one of the interesting things about this process is that some individual cells, turn into spores early. Some try and do it late. The ones that do it early survive as these bright, phase bright objects here and here. Other ones die. And there's a little bit of an issue here as to why it is in this genetically identical population that some cells do one thing and some cells do another. And in fact, this particular bacteria is capable of responding in many different ways to stress, such as starvation. One of them is the sporulation process. So we'd like to ask the question, when you see phenotypic behaviors like this that are highly variable at the single cell level, where is that variability coming from? That's the most general question we're interested in. There it is again. Okay. So now there's a number of different places that variability could arise, right? The most obvious one is genetic variability. So all of us are genetically different in this room. But of course, you can control for that in biological experiments by growing clonal populations of cells, that is, populations of cells that are all genetically identical. So you can eliminate that source of variation. And then, of course, you can have environmental variation, that is to say that different cells can be living in different environments with slightly different conditions, and that can cause different cells to respond differently or to act or behave differently. For example, in the movie I just showed you, you might think that there's little microenvironmental differences in the locations that the individual cells are inhabiting, and that might contribute to why one cell does something different than another cell. Then there's issues about the history of the cell. So we know of many processes in bacteria and other organisms that have a kind of memory. So if the cell has experienced some condition in the past, and you put in a new condition, it in a sense remembers the previous state. And that can give you what are called epigenetic effects, memory effects inside the cell. And the final source that I'm going to focus on in the first part of the talk is stochasticity. So that's just the idea that the operation of the cell might be inherently stochastic, non-deterministic. And the interesting thing about that type of variation is that it arises de novo within the cell. And so we can ask the question, are stochastic effects actually significant in the behavior of cells? Do they really matter? Or are they pretty much negligible? And if they do matter, then we'd like to know how much of a cell's behavior, how much of its decisions on what to do, are really even in principle unpredictable. And if that's the case, they'd be difficult to understand how the cell would control itself. Okay. So the reason we think stochasticity may be important is just mainly based on the fact that the cell is small and contains a very low copy number of a lot of important molecules, the most obvious one and most central one being DNA. So the chromosome is typically present in, one or two copies per cell, most organisms. And typical regulatory protein concentrations can be on the order of tens or hundreds per cell. And this is just a quick Monte Carlo simulation of a very simple network that we can imagine, which is just some molecule X being created at a constant rate K, being degraded at a constant rate D. And of course, if this was a continuous system, you would expect if you started it with zero molecules, that it would increase exponentially to the ratio of K over D, which here is about 40. But if you simulate this, you expect to get these erratic trajectories. And this is really an idea, I think, that goes way back, I think, to Delbruck, and was really worked out theoretically by McAdams and Arkin in the 90s in a series of papers where they showed what effects you would expect to have on gene expression because of stochasticity, and how you would expect that to affect natural processes such as decisions by bacteriophages on whether to kill cells or to lysogenize them. So that work was mainly through simulations and theory, but it was unclear experimentally how important these effects really were. Okay, of course, it's easy to look at gene expression in E. coli, and this example shows you just a field of bacterial cells. This is E. coli expressing GFP. And you can see some of the cells are bright, some are dim, and this they all never, despite the fact that they're all genetically identical. Okay, so again, clonal population, and they're grown in a uniform environment here. And so we can now ask our question with respect to the process of gene expression. Is gene expression a deterministic function of the state of the cell, or is it a stochastic function of the state of the cell? And how could we even know the difference? And there's some circumstantial evidence going way back for why, for people who think they see stochasticity in gene expression. This is an example of a multinucleate muscle cell. And these are different nuclei in the same cell. And this kind of messy staining here is meant to show that some of these nuclei are expressing a particular transcript, particular messenger RNA species, while other ones are not in the same condition. And this variability was considered to be kind of circumstantial evidence to suggest that they might be switching stochastically between an expressing state and a non-expressing state. But of course, it's hard to say whether that's really stochastic, because these nuclei might differ from one another in many different ways. So the ideal experiment you'd like to do is to take two perfectly identical cells at the initial point in time, put them in an identical environment, and wait a while and see if they're still identical. Right? This is what we mean for something to be deterministic. It means that if you put it in the same initial condition and you leave in the same environment, it will these two things will continue to be the same. And conversely, if they seem to be different after a certain amount of time, you would say that there must be something stochastic going on if they started out the same. The problem is that you can never do this, because you can't prepare two cells in an identical state. Okay? So even if you look at the closest related bacterial cells you can find, which are two sister cells that have just divided from one another, you find all sorts of differences between them. So it's very difficult, or basically impossible, to do this type of experiment. And so instead of putting two identical cells in the same environment, we can do something else, which is we can put two identical genes in the same cell. This is slightly different. And this is the idea of our experiment. We take two colors of green fluorescent protein. So are people familiar with green fluorescent protein in biological? Okay. So these are called CFP and YFP. They'll be represented here by these green and red genes. And we put them under identical promoters. So that means that the regulatory sequence information is the same in front of both of the genes. And they're in the same cell, so they feel the same concentrations of cellular factors. And now we just ask, does the level of expression of these two genes correlate, or is it uncorrelated? So we're using here stable proteins, so these actually don't degrade at all inside E. coli. So their only concentration is only reduced through the process of cell division and dilution during growth. But we'll be looking mostly at steady state conditions. Yeah. So there's two extreme possibilities you can imagine. Well, I guess quasi-steady state. So batch culture and kind of exponential phase. Yeah. That's when we look at them usually. That we grow a batch culture and they're exponential. But of course, you're right, that's not really steady state. But it's the kind of microbiologist version of steady state. So there's two extreme possibilities. One is that the cell's behaving deterministically, in which case both of these genes would remain correlated with each other over time. And in a population, if green and red made yellow, you'd see some bright yellow cells and some dim yellow cells. But they'd all have a yellow color to them. In other words, the same ratio of expression of the two genes. And the extreme other possibility is that it could be dominated by stochastic effects, in which case the expression of these two genes would fluctuate independently. And you might imagine something like this happening over time, in which case you might see red cells, green cells, and yellow cells in a population. Okay, this was the idea. And so what we did was we built strains that implemented this type of experiment. And the way we did that was we took the chromosome of E. coli, which is a circular DNA molecule, and we put the CFP and YFP gene on opposite sides of this thing called ORC, which is the origin of replication. And we tried to put them in approximately equal distances from the origin of replication. And the reason for that has to do with the way that DNA replication works in E. coli, whereby replication forks proceed from this origin of replication in both directions. And so the copy number of an individual part of the chromosome could be different depending on where it is and where in the cell cycle you are. So early genes can have higher copy numbers than late genes. And we just wanted to make sure that the average copy numbers of these two genes were the same. Okay. And then we just used the fluorescence microscope to take pictures of these cells and see what they looked like. And so here's a field of E. coli cells at fairly high density. This is phase contrast, so the cells appear dark. Here's the same cells in CFP, so now we're looking at how much of the CFP gene is being expressed in each cell. That's what the brightness here refers to. And here, the YFP intensity. And if you go back and forth between the CFP and YFP images, you'll see that some cells are brighter in one channel and some are brighter in the other channel. Okay. So, in that sense, these cells appear to be behaving stochastically. In other words, you see both yellow, green, and red. This projector is a little more on the green side. But anyway, so this image, in a way, is a picture of how noisy cellular behavior or gene expression is in these conditions. Okay, the way we do the real experiment is we actually put them down at lower density. We have the computer identify cells, and then we pull out the fluorescence intensities. And before I show you what the data looks like, I wanted to just make one quick comment about what has to, about a condition that we assume is true and we verify is true for these strains. And that is that because the genes are actually in different places, it's important that they really be regulated the same way. We've assumed they are because we put in the same promoters and so on, but we can also test that they are. And the way we do that is we take a histogram of cell of intensities in the CFP and YFP channels over many conditions. And these are just two overlapping histograms in green and red. And the idea is that this is over two orders of magnitude in intensity on the x-axis. And all we've done is scale the arbitrary values that we get out of our camera of YFP intensity by some one constant factor over this range. In this case, it happens to be 0.125. And you can show that the distributions, in fact, are consistent with the distribution for each of the colors is consistent with it coming from the same distribution. So there's no significant difference between them, which is to say that at least on average, we can't tell the difference between the two genes in terms of their regulation under these conditions. Yeah, so this has to do with the kind of silly way we did this. We made this data, but basically, in fact, they were grown in three different conditions, so that, and these are just overlapping histograms of those three conditions with the two different colors. That's right. Okay. And so the data you get, if you think about it, you can get an intensity value for the CFP and intensity value for the YFP for each cell. And so if you imagine plotting these on a graph, you would plot a dot for each cell, and this would be CFP versus YFP. And now the noisiness or the characteristics of the strain are really summarized by the shape of this cloud of points, in some sense. Here I've just plotted two different strains, one in blue and one in green. And the way to think about this is to imagine that there were no intrinsic noise in gene expression. In other words, that we were in that deterministic regime where they were always correlated. Then the CFP and everything, all the dots would lie exactly along this diagonal line, right? But in fact, they're not. They're spread out a little bit perpendicular to it. And so the spread, the RMS deviation from that diagonal line in this perpendicular direction is a measure of how important these non-deterministic stochastic effects really are inside the cell. And we're going to call that intrinsic noise. Okay. Now you also notice that the cloud is not circular. In other words, there is a correlation coefficient that's greater than zero here. So the extra spread along the diagonal minus the spread perpendicular to the diagonal, that extra variation, we're going to call that extrinsic noise. And what that is all the things that would vary from cell to cell but affect both of our promoters in the same way in any given cell, right? And so we call that extrinsic noise. And we define these two quantities in such a way that if you add the squares of the intrinsic and extrinsic noise, you get the square of the sort of one color noise, which is the coefficient of variation you would measure if you only had one of these two colors in the cell. And the interpretation of them is just what I've told you. Intrinsic noise affects two identical genes independently, whereas extrinsic noise affects two identical genes similarly. And you can think about this way, that there's all these different factors in the cell, like ribosomes, polymerases, transcription factors, extracellular factors, all these things that could differ from cell to cell. These would all be kind of extrinsic variables. And all the little events that happen at an individual copy of a gene, like binding to a polymerase, binding to a ribosome, and so on, those we would call intrinsic events. Sources of intrinsic noise. Okay. Now, the two things are not really independent. Why? Because if you have intrinsic noise in the expression of one gene, and that gene is regulating the second gene, then the second gene experiences the variation in the regulator as a source of extrinsic noise, but it also has its own source of intrinsic noise as well. So you can see that noise can propagate in a gene regulation network. Okay. So one of the things we like to do a lot of these movies, and here's a movie of cells that are expressing these promoters very high level. You see that they're entirely the same color, with the exception of a couple little cells that look kind of sick. One turns red and one turns green. See this guy here? This guy here. And what you're seeing here is a very low level of noise in these cells. And in fact, it's basically like in these conditions. So these are very strong promoters that come from viruses that infect these bacteria. And these very strong viral promoters put out so much protein that, in fact, the noise is pretty negligible. And we actually, in fact, these cells are so uniform that they're very useful for calibrating the deviations from uniformity of your fluorescence lamp across the field of view of your microscope. They're actually better than beads for us anyway. They're just very uniform. However, of course, we thought, well, that's all nice, but what happens when you go down to more typical physiological levels of gene expression, such as the levels that most genes are expressed? See, these promoters are used mainly when the phage is killing the cell, so it's just trying to make as many copies of itself as possible. This is the type of expression level you see from a promoter that's involved in normal functions. And then, when you go down to these levels, you start to see all sorts of colors appearing, and you start to see the noise go way up to on the order of about 25% or 30% for intrinsic and extrinsic. Okay. So the bottom line is that noise can be quite significant. Okay. And in fact, we can vary the level of expression over two orders of magnitude and follow how the intrinsic noise goes down with the expression level. And the simplest thing you might imagine if it's generated by a Poisson process is just that this go down as the square root of the expression level. And in fact, it does start to go down as the square root, but it doesn't go all the way to zero. It seems to go to a constant at high levels of expression. This constant can have a number of different sources. One is just measurement error, which is the fact that we can't really measure CFP and YFP independently and accurately enough to ever get this thing to go down to zero. Another thing that's probably more important is actually stochasticity in the replication process. So the fact that one of the sides of the replication fork might progress faster from time to time than the other side, and that could give you a transient imbalance. That's something else that you would expect not to go to zero as the expression level goes very high. Yeah, that's right. So we could check. That's checkable, but we haven't checked it. Yeah. But the point is that if you turn up the transcription level from the promoters, that source of variation doesn't reduce in any way. It's just you're just amplifying that variation. So, The curious thing is that if you looked at the extrinsic noise, this goes up and then goes down again. So that's these green points here. And at first we kind of scratch our heads about that. And this turns out to be related actually to variability in the regulator of the promoters we're looking at. So we're moving along this x-axis by adding an inducer called IPTG that binds to a repressor that's turning off our promoters. And that repressor is itself a gene, and it's going to fluctuate also. And so the idea is that at intermediate levels of induction, we're putting approximately as much IPTG as repressor into each cell. And so you can kind of amplify fluctuations in the repressor level, whereas at either extreme, you have very little extrinsic noise in the sense that you usually have much more IPTG than repressor or much more repressor than IPTG. Okay. You can also look at other promoters to see if they fall on the same curve. This is an unrelated promoter, these red points here. And this dashed red line is the intrinsic noise curve that we measured on the first set of promoters. And you can see that these points are consistent with the red dashed line. So this shows the property I now call tuniversality. So if you measure the same property for two things, it's not quite universal, but it's tuniversal. But it does suggest the possibility that there might be that intrinsic noise, if it's generated just by this kind of Poisson production process, might be something that really only depends on the production rate. But that's something you'd have to verify by looking at other promoters. The outline point? Which one? So these are extrinsic noise points. So the red ones are the intrinsic noise, and those lie on the curve. The extrinsic is more complicated because this is actually an activated promoter that's activated by lambda repressor, which can also be an activator. And so that's a little bit more complicated, why those are like that. So. In this case, we're basically just expressing, the reason you have kind of a few points up here at high levels and a few at low levels is because either we just put a low constitutive amount of lambda repressor in, or we induce it with actually another induction system, and then we get a lot, and it's very hard to reliably get a medium amount with the system, which is why when we do try and get a medium amount, we end up with high extrinsic noise. That's kind of an artifact of the way we're inducing them. But the idea is that basically that these intrinsic noise points fall on the same line. Well, the expression level of the gene rather than the concentration of the transcription. So the x-axis is the expression level of the target. These are different transcription factors now, rather than, so the idea is that they're different promoters and they're controlled by different transcription factors. One's repressed by LAC and the other is activated by lambda repressor. And so what we're comparing them with is this x-axis scale, which is just the level of expression from the promoter, which is the one thing that we can compare between the two. Now we are holding constant the translational signals, the ribosome binding sites between the two experiments. Right. Yes. Yes. I didn't want to make that a statement as weak as possible, but yeah, it's just a consistent. Yeah, that's all I'm saying, is that it didn't have to be that way, right? It could have depended on the promoter, it could have depended on the activator. And we've now varied two things at the same time, activator and promoter, you get the same. Yeah, so expression level here, these are normalized, but it's the units just have to do with the brightness of expression. So we're measuring using a fluorescence microscope and a CCD camera. So we normalize, there's two ways to normalize. One is we're using beads, fluorescent beads that have a known, intensity. Or sometimes actually we find that our very strongly expressing ones, the ones I showed you before, are pretty reproducible, so we use those. Yeah. That's the biocalibration. Okay. Now, a curious thing we noticed was that if we took all the different strains we'd made that had these double promoter systems in them, some of them were very quiet, like this, and others at the same average level of expression looked noisier. And it turned out that all the noisy ones had a deletion in the RECA gene. And in fact, you can verify that that's what's causing this, because if you take these quiet strains and delete the RECA gene, they become noisy, okay, like this. And so I'm saying that we originally had several different strains we had made. We just took all the strains lying around the lab and put these promoters into them. Then we just to see if there was a lot of strain variation in the level of noise. Then it turned out that there was, that there were two classes, basically. A class that were all pretty much the same in this sense, they were pretty quiet. And then another class that all looked more or less like this. If you looked at the genotypes of these two classes, they differ in the sense that these always have a deletion in RECA, and they can differ in many other ways as well. And to check that the RECA was the thing causing the increase in noise, we deleted the RECA from a quiet strain and turned it into a noisy strain. Okay, so this raises the question of whether there can be, in a way, genetic control of noise, and which would be interesting from a point of view of whether cells can evolve different noise levels and so on. Now, the trouble with this particular gene, RECA, is that it's very pleiotropic, Recce is involved in recombination, which is where it gets its name. It's also involved in DNA repair and many other processes in the cell. And so we wondered really what Recce was actually doing here. We'll skip that. But, well, it has a function of replication in the sense that you can get lesions sort of during replication that cause the replication forks to halt. And Recce is involved in repairing those lesions so the replication forks can keep going. So in that sense, it does. And I have a little slide of that. So if you look at these guys growing over time, follow these guys down here. We're going to move them up. Yep, there they go. You can see they start to get noisy. And then they just kind of lose it. And this is not because there's something wrong with the conditions or the cells. This is because these things are genomically unstable, apparently. They filament and die, and all the cells around them are perfectly happy. And in fact, what you find in general is that in order to do the measurement of these Recce cells, we have to record all the cells we measure at time zero. And then to decide whether they had been alive at the time we measured them, we come back many hours later and see whether they've stopped growing like that, they reach a point where they can't survive, or whether they kind of grow to infinity. And that's what we define as being having been alive at time zero, although you can see that that's a kind of arbitrary definition of having been alive. But the main point is that even if we restrict our measurements to just those cells that by this definition were alive at time zero, they still have a much higher level of noise at the same expression level. Okay. And so this, as I was saying before, this is our model of what might be happening, and this is also a testable prediction that we have not yet actually tested, though. And the idea is that you get lesions in DNA, these block progress of replication forks, whereas the other replication fork moving out in the opposite direction can go ahead and replicate the gene, and this, you can imagine, would lead to an imbalance in the colors, and it would also lead to a kind of genomic instability where replication would be halted in one place. And this is known to cause cells to filament, like we see, and to become sort of genomically unstable. And so this is not a very healthy state to be in. Okay. Now, which we really ought to do, yeah. So there's a lot of things that you could do, I think, by moving these things around and looking at the effects. So I just wanted to mention that this basic approach has now been done in yeast by Aaron O'Shea's lab at UCSF. And what they did was they actually took a... The nice thing about yeast is you can make diploid strains. These have two copies of every chromosome. And so it's a very natural experiment to do in a diploid organism because you always have, for every gene anyway, two copies. They're often different alleles if you have heterozygosity. And it's very natural to make one allele CFP, one allele YFP, and then to ask how much noise you get. The interesting thing they found is that, yes, they could detect intrinsic noise in yeast, but what they found was that extrinsic noise is actually the dominant source of variation. So most of the variability was coming from extrinsic sources rather than from gene expression itself. Okay, so this is sort of a picture of how the origins of variation that it comes from just taking these static snapshots primarily. But we'd like to ask now what happens if you add dynamics, changes in gene expression over time, and gene regulation to this picture. Yeah. Yeah, I think the intrinsic noise levels were fairly comparable. Yeah. Well, they didn't measure it. I think the dominant force was that the extrinsic noise was much higher. That's the main effect. Yeah. Okay. So now I want to change gears a little, just a slightly, and say what happens when you look at gene regulation at the single cell level. And so, in very general terms, when you ask about how genes are regulated, you imagine there's a promoter and it binds to several different transcription factors, and these in some combinatorial fashion determine the level of expression of the gene. So in other words, the concentrations and states of these factors determine the rate of expression of this target gene. And of course, the simplest case is when you only have a single transcription factor, which can be a repressor, and that'll be what I'll show you. Okay. And when you write down models of gene regulation networks, you always find yourself coming across this function, which we're going to call the regulation function. And this function is what relates the concentration of the regulator or repressor to the activity of the promoter. In other words, the rate of increase of the rate of production of the target gene. And the important thing about this function is that it's really the main thing that the dynamics depend on in any of the networks that we're usually interested in studying, whether they're natural or synthetic. Certain features of it, such as the cooperativity, how sharply this thing goes down, are crucial for bistability or oscillations. However, given that we know now that there's a lot of noise in the cell, different types, it's not really clear if this is well-defined at the single-cell level. And even if it was well-defined, it's actually never been measured in single cells. So we don't really know, well, not just in single cells, never really measured in vivo. Because in order to measure it in vivo, you really have to look at individual cells. And the reason you have to look at individual cells is you need a simultaneous measurement of how much repressor you have and how fast the target gene is being expressed. Okay. So to get a rate out, you need measurements in the same cell over time. Okay. And you have to, in that same cell, measure the repressor. And you don't want to average over each of these axes independently, because then that might smear out the curve if it was very sharp. Okay. And so this is our model of E. coli, and this is what I showed to remind you that it's a very high-density environment inside, and so it's far from the very well-studied biochemistry of the test tube, where you can write down a very exact rate law. Okay, so again, the challenge is we have to both measure and vary the concentration of repressor inside the cell, and also the rate of expression of the target gene at the same time. Well, to do that, we built strains. Is this blocked on the bottom here? The idea of the strains is that they form a three-level cascade of repression. We have this gene called TET-R, which turns off a fusion of the lambda repressor to YFP, which again is red, and that turns off CFP, which is green. And the crucial thing here is that there's a small molecule called anhydrotetracycline, which can break this cascade, and you can use that to induce the expression of this repressor. Okay. And now the idea is that by varying the concentration of this repressor, we can look at how much repressor we have, and we can look at the production rate of its downstream gene. We can do it simultaneously inside single cells. So that's what we want to do. Now, of course, the problem is it's a little awkward. Even though you have this small molecule, it's a little awkward to move along this x-axis. And so to do that, we use a trick that we call, it's not really a trick. Oh. We use the natural fact that as cells grow, repressors are diluted during growth. And so the idea of the experiment is just before the experiment starts, we give a little pulse of expression of the repressor and then turn off its production. And so we turn it off at time zero. And then what we would expect on a log scale is to get a staircase down, as every time the cell divides, about half the repressor goes to each daughter cell. So if you follow one cell, it just takes these steps down every cell cycle, boom, 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 twofold, twofold, twofold. At the same time, and this is plotted on a linear scale, we can look at the amount of CFP. And of course, at the beginning, you have lots of repressor, and so this is just also taking these twofold steps down. But when the repressor level gets low enough, then this promoter, CFP promoter, can start to turn on. And the slope here on these steps is really the activity of this promoter. So we measure the slope of this green line versus the level of the red line. And that should give us what we want. Okay. And here's a movie of what that actually looks like inside cells. This cell contains repressor. That's the red here. And you'll see that it's not being produced and it's not being degraded. It's just being diluted out during growth. And when the level gets low enough, you can see the green expression of this green gene start to come on. Localized at the ends of the colony? No, the green is, no.
Early on.
Oh, the red, you mean?
No, but the ends of the
green. The ends of an individual cell? They shouldn't be. Yeah, if they appear like that, they shouldn't. It's pretty uniform. What's not uniform, actually, is the repressor, because the repressor binds DNA non-specifically, and so it tends to be clustered in the middle of the cell, but not the poles. Okay. Good. So. Oh, yeah. You can definitely see, in fact, about the non-specific binding affinity. I think we can, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's very, very visible. I can see. Let's see. I was going to try and click on this thing. Let's see if this works. This is a more zoomed-in movie. I think it's saturated. The trouble is, when we make these movies, you see that you kind of see a little cluster in it? Yeah, it's only one frame. But let's see. Maybe here. You can kind of see a little clustering in the middle here. And I could show you better images, but that's more obvious. Okay, and then we built a kind of a set of image analysis tools that allow us to go from a phase contrast image of a colony to a segmented picture of it. So here the idea is that these colors just represent different individual cells. This is semi-automatic process. And then from there we track them over time, and that allows us to put together a family tree of the microcolony. Here's a typical one. When these things stop, it doesn't mean they're dead. It just means we stopped following them for some reason. We rarely see things actually die. And then from that lineage, from that tree, you can spit out any particular lineage like that and follow it over time. Okay, and then you can look at the data and you can ask, does the data actually look like we thought it would? And in fact, it pretty much does. You get these twofold steps down in repressor concentration, as expected, and we get this expression of the target gene, which you can see starts to slope up a little here and here, and it starts to get steeper and steeper and steeper and steeper. So again, the repressor is on a log scale, but the target gene is on a linear scale. And we do that because the slope is best seen on the linear scale, but these twofold steps are nice on the log scale. And so what you can see here are an individual cell, which is in the dark curves, and then all the other kind of dim ones in the background are the rest of the cells in the microcolony. And so now we can look from that, we can look at what the regulation function looks like. Here's the first raw data. You can, each of these dots is one pair of time points, neighboring time points, which gives us one value for the rate, which is the difference in level of CFP over one of these pairs of time points, versus the amount of the repressor. And you can see that there's a lot, substantial amount of variation, but you can also see the general trend of the curve. And the second thing we can do is that because we have all of these division events, we can just ask whether proteins are divided equally between two daughter cells. So now you imagine there's a lot of protein in this cell. Two daughter cells each should get, on average, about half, but if things are happening in an unbiased random way, then each protein might be flipping a coin to decide which daughter it would go to. That would give you a binomial process, and if that was the case, you would expect the average error, in other words, the average difference between these two daughter cells, to go as the square root of the total amount in the initial cell. Now, why do we care about that? The reason we care about that is by fitting these errors, that's a one-parameter fit that gives us something we're really interested in, namely the fluorescence of an individual molecule, right? So the idea is that even though we can't detect a single GFP molecule in these cells because the autofluorescence is far too high, we can still calibrate the fluorescence in terms of individual molecules using this type of approach. Ah, sorry. So each blue dot here represents one division event, and the x-axis is the total amount of repressor in the parent cell, and the y-axis is the error between the difference between how much went into each of the two daughters. And so the idea is these are all over the place, but if you bin them in bins, then they fall on this curve that goes at the square root of the total. And so the idea is that it's a random binomial random process, but the average goes as the square root. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, the best example of something it wants is the chromosome, and the chromosome, of course, even though it's at a few copies, is perfectly partitioned. Yeah, and also there's plasmids similarly that have active segregation systems. So this doesn't have to happen like this, but it does appear with the proteins, at least some of these proteins, that it does happen like this. Okay, as a result, you can now get what the average shape of these regulation functions really are, and you can see, in fact, they can be well fit by Hill functions. That's what these solid lines are. And we actually did two versions, differing only by a single point mutation in one of the operators that bound to the repressor. So this promoter has two slightly different operators, OR1 and OR2. These both bind to lambda repressor, and we just put an affinity weakening mutation that was previously characterized in one of these. And the result of that is to shift the affinity out to higher values and to reduce the cooperativity substantially. So we now have a real in vivo biochemistry where we can say what these parameters are in molecular units. We can measure the cooperativities, which actually can be quite high. So we get for wild type 2.4, 1.7 with this mutation. And we get all these values in real units. But the main thing that makes this interesting is how it... let me say one other thing we can do is, so far we've used this fusion of the repressor to a fluorescent protein, so we can see it. But to measure some of these parameters, you don't even have to see the protein. So if you don't look at the YFP signal and you assume that it's partitioned 50-50 between daughter cells, then you can still estimate the cooperativity N. And if you do that, you get the right answer to within 10%, usually. So the nice thing about that is if you want to generalize this to other systems, but you don't want to mess them up by putting a fluorescent protein on the repressor, you can still at least measure this one characteristic of them, the cooperativity. Okay. But the interesting thing about the data really is the variability. So that's the part where it departs from our classical idea of how these things should work. And I just want to show you three different ways in which you can imagine something fluctuating. This would be fluctuations that are fast relative to the cell cycle. These are fluctuations that are correlated with the cell cycle. This is like a periodic signal. And these are correlations that have the same time scale as the cell cycle, but are not particularly correlated with it. Although these look more correlated than they're supposed to. And so what we tried to do is we tried to break up the variation in the production rate into different components that we could understand. And the first thing we did was we plotted this average curve versus, say, one of the particular individual lineages. And you can see it seems to fluctuate slowly around the average curve. Okay. To make that precise, we computed an autocorrelation function. And here it's the autocorrelation function of basically the ratio of the production rate to what you would expect the production rate to be given the amount of repressor in that cell at that time. Okay. And this thing has an autocorrelation function which decays with a time scale of about 40 minutes, which is basically the cell cycle. So what it looks like is you have slow fluctuations of one cell cycle time scale that in the production rate. Okay. So then you can ask, well, where are these fluctuations coming from? And from the first part of the talk, we know of at least two different categories we could put them in. One would be intrinsic, one would be extrinsic. And so we just made a variant of that first experiment where we knock out the fluorescence of the repressor using a single point mutation, and we put YFP downstream of it. And so now we have one of these symmetric branch strains. And using this strain, we can now ask, what's the time scale of the fluctuation, the intrinsic fluctuations in the production rate? And that decays much more quickly, so with a time scale of about 9 minutes. Okay. So we can also get the relative amplitudes of the two contributions. And it turns out that the dominant, I can show you a movie of that actually. Oops. So that's what this looks like. Now we're not seeing a repressor diluting at all because it's invisible, but it is being diluted. And when it gets to a low enough level, you'll start to see both colors turn on simultaneously, nearly simultaneously. You can see there's noise. Well, color's not so great, but you can see some noise actually in this movie. And if you look at the time scale of those fluctuations, you'll find that they decorrelate with this fast time scale. So as a result, we actually have examples of all three of these types of processes. So we have fast fluctuations. Those are the intrinsic noise. These have a time scale of about 10 minutes. We have these slow extrinsic fluctuations with a time scale of about a cell cycle. And actually, what I didn't show you is that we also can see some evidence for a cell cycle effect. And the main evidence there is that if you look at cells at the end of the cell cycle, and you look at the distribution of production rates, and you compare it to cells at the beginning of the cell cycle, they overlap and are displaced by about a factor of 2. So that's consistent with the idea that you have twice as many copies of the gene at the end of the cell cycle as you had at the beginning of the cell cycle. And so you actually have all three components. But in terms of amplitude, this slow extrinsic fluctuation is the dominant factor. The mRNAs, on average, in E. coli are about 2 to 3 minutes. We haven't measured for But the 9 minutes, I should say, mainly what we can say is that the time scale is less than 9 minutes because our time resolution is about 8 to 9 minutes, plus there's a folding time of GFP, which is on the order of 5 to 10 minutes. So we can't, it could be much faster than 10 minutes, but it's no slower than that. Okay. And so the main thing I wanted to say is that the idea here is that we have these slow extrinsic fluctuations. So if you think about this from the point of view of the cell, if what you want to do is accurately produce your target gene based on the concentration of your regulator, what do you do? Because your whole system is fluctuating slowly over time. In order to integrate out those fluctuations, you'd have to wait many cell cycles, which is a long time from the point of view of one of these bacterial cells. And so, therefore, these slow fluctuations in a way limit the accuracy with which you can translate a concentration of a transcriptional regulator into an accurate output based on these mean regulation functions. Okay. The other thing is, from the point of view of the cell as a whole, all the major cellular components, since they're also produced from genes, might be subject to the same variability we see in our test gene. So the picture is that ribosomes, polymerases, all these other cellular components might also themselves be undergoing these slow fluctuations in expression level and production rate. And as a result, we just have a picture of the cell in which all these components are fluctuating. And what's not clear is if they're all fluctuating in a coherent way, kind of in a correlated way, or in an uncorrelated way. But that's something that can be checked. And finally, if nothing else, we get the biochemistry of gene regulation at the single cell level. We can take these averages and we can get all the biochemical parameters in real molecular units. And essentially all we're doing is watching movies of suitably engineered strains. And so this is an appealing alternative to doing the traditional biochemistry where you break cells open, you take large populations, and you try and measure average properties that way. So the properties we're measuring here can't really be accessed without looking at individual cells. And so they are, in fact, the idea here is that they are accessible. We can measure them. We can do it directly in a non-invasive way. And that can be very useful from the point of view both of designing synthetic networks, which is one of the things that my lab is interested in, as well as for characterizing or trying to understand or model how natural genetic circuits work inside cells. Okay. So, of course, I have to thank a lot of people. The first half of the talk was a collaboration with Peter Swain, who's now at McGill, as well as Eric Sigia and Arnie Levine, who were then at Rockefeller. And the second part of the talk on gene regulation was done with Jonathan Young in my lab, with lots and lots of work from Nitzan Rosenfeld, who's a student in Uri Alon's lab, and again with Peter Swain. Anyway, thanks very much. We'd be happy to take questions. Yeah, so,
and what can you really look at?
So that we can't see everything. I mean, there is a limit, but the typical, so what we, first of all, we can measure these effective concentrations, right? These are the concentrations of repressors that give you about half maximal expression, and these turn out to be, at least for the wild type, on the order of about 50 molecules per cell, okay? So now our error here is about 10, so it's a 20%, 55 plus or minus 10 molecules per cell is what we can measure, and if you start to get much below that, then we really do have a floor because the autofluorescence is on the order of, say, 10 to 20 molecules per cell that we can detect. And we really can't see things when they start to get, we can't measure them accurately when they start to get close to that. So that is the limit. But again, the nice thing is that we can calibrate these in terms of individual molecules even though we can't detect them. It's binomial. Although I should say that it becomes worse than binomial. We cut that graph off. If you follow that graph out further on the x-axis, it becomes linear rather than square root. So it eventually becomes worse than binomial.
Some of them are accurate, but they're not. very much set up the rest of the time. So it's one of the one high affinity and finding type. And there were only two copies of the first.
Yeah. So we're, yeah, I think we wouldn't, so we can't really see less than like 10 or 20. So we're never in that regime where you're only looking at the specific sites. So I think we're in a regime always where the two or four specific sites are probably always full. No, I take that back. It's not true.
Well,
yeah, and see what would happen. Although we know that the affinity is not, right, we know that it takes 50 molecules to half occupy a specific site. But just having a specific site is not a guarantee that it'll be filled 100% of the time. Depends on the affinity. So you can maybe imagine making it even stronger affinity site. Yeah. No, I guess our idea was basically that at the beginning, everything is bound to DNA, whether it's specific or non-specific. And the two DNA molecules that get segregated to the two daughter cells, those are exactly equal size. Okay. And so if, in that sense, each molecule has to choose between two exactly equal possible things to stick to. Now, when you go to higher levels of expression of the repressor, I think you start to get some cytoplasmic repressor. And that, you could imagine, would segregate like the the way the volume of the cytoplasm segregates. And that would give you a linear error. And the slope of that linear error would basically be proportional to the error the cell is making in where it puts its own septum.
Did you think that hypothesis that at low levels of linear repressor in the mini cell or something like that? Where the mini cell will allow you to see what's not bound to DNA and look at the free concentration?
Ah, that's a good point. You're right. That's true. Yeah, no, we haven't. No, you're right. We could very easily, we have, in fact, a mini cell strain. We could just put that in. That's a good point. Yeah, we could do that. And then I guess you'd vary the concentration of the repressor, and you just see as a function of that what fraction lands in the mini cell, typically. Yeah. In 8 or 9 minutes. No, it's the cell cycle here is about 45 minutes, and our time resolution is about 8 or 9 minutes. So yeah, the reason we do that is because we want to. So actually, we measure the repressor less often because we only need one measurement of repressor per cell cycle because it's constant. But we measure the CFP like 5 or 6 times per cell cycle, because we want to be able to make a difference in the amount to make the derivative.
Right.
And
it's
the sampling. And I think if we tried to sample faster, which we could, then I think we would be limited by the folding time of GFP at some point, around 5 minutes.
Spectrum is a low frequency.
So what happens is, so now you can, we take our derivative over two time points. And the simple, normally what we do is we just plot if they're the two consecutive time points. But you can also take the window and make it larger and measure the derivative averaged over a longer period of time, right? And when you do that, basically you start averaging out the intrinsic component, but you find that the extrinsic component stays more or less the same. In other words, the amplitude of the noise decreases by an amount equal to the intrinsic contribution.
So the extrinsic noise may still be mostly at the shell cycle, because the ore can be lower.
Yes.
So the question is, how much noise are left with if you subtract the average out fluctuations of the natural process?
If we average out the fluctuations.
Is there much left, or?
So I think, we haven't, let me see. So that would correspond to our moving that time window out to one cell cycle and then asking what's the amplitude of the noise, for example.
Very small variability corresponds to cells in different states.
So
the question is whether the intrinsic noise is used in processes used for replication or division, or is it used in different functional equations?
Right. So I guess this. Not sure how to answer it. I don't know if we've done exactly the right analysis to answer that, but we have done this autocorrelation function, and so there, that in a way summarizes the results of all the different time windows, right? But if I tell you that the autocorrelation function is exponential, does that tell you everything you need to know? The answer there is that it's exponential, and the correlation time is 40 minutes, which is pretty close to 45 minutes, which is the cell cycle. Now, I have to say, of course, that the cell cycle itself varies. If you look on our trees, it can vary quite substantially from cell to cell. So the average autocorrelation time is similar to the average cell cycle time. But we could also maybe try and analyze, with respect to individual lineages, given that we actually know their individual cell cycles, what does that do? But at the same time, it's often hard to say exactly where one cell cycle starts and another ends, because the only real clue you have in these experiments is when you can really see by eye the septation event. And that tends to be a little bit arbitrary, at least in my experience. Like, I might call this then divided at a particular point. The computer program might do it at a little different point. And one could dream up maybe a way of actually saying when the cell cycle started and ended, but it's not clear. You do at the beginning, but it gets hard to tell later. And also, your gene may be replicated before the two clumps are separated from each other. Presumably, it probably is. Let's see, cell-cell variation, don't know of anything that has measured that ever. What has been done, though, is the average variation of this was done with a microarray experiment from, I'm not sure who, I know that Pat Brown, I think Joe DeRizzi at UCSF did this. It was very nice, and they looked at, I think they took synchronized cells, and I think they looked at, as a function, they took different time points and they looked at the rate at which expression increased at each locus as you went linearly along the chromosome. And so they could kind of plot the average velocity as a function of position along the chromosome. And that's pretty nice. And I think there were some interesting features there. In other words, it wasn't just constant velocity around. There were some pausing sites and stuff. But that's not cell-cell variability. That's kind of variability along the chromosome. That's a nice paper. So we think that that's possible, and of course there's ways we could check that. Yeah. That it could be stochastic. As well as it could be some things that are part of the dependent on the sequence, and some components that are also stochastic. And I'm not sure, I mean, short of putting the GFPs at every possible position, the reason originally was I actually wanted to see if that was significant. And I thought, I'll tell you the truth. The reason was because for historical reasons, I already had one CFP in one place, and then I just put the other one on the opposite side. Yeah. For other reasons, we're now building strains that have different CFP and YFP next to each other. So those are for different experiments, but in the process, we may, for free, be able to check how much of the noise is eliminated under those conditions. Yeah. Sure. Wait, sorry, not that one. You mean that one? Yeah, so you can see actually variability in the cell cycle in this graph, by the way. You like that? Yes. Well, there's no production or degradation. So in the ideal case, these would be a perfect staircase of flat steps. You're looking at the of the repressor. Yes. This is per cell. So the idea is here, there's a division event right here, and now you see what happens. This cell here divided into this guy and this guy. And so this plus this should add up to this. And you can see actually here's an error, right? Similarly, let's see, this one made a huge error, right? Because one of them goes down to here, and the other one's here. So we make a... Yeah. So what we do is we model the cell as a... Yeah, that's what we do. So we model the cell as a cylinder of length, observed length, width, observed width, and hemispherical caps. And then we take that volume, and we use our estimate of the number of molecules per cell to give us a concentration. And then you end up basically with a conversion factor, which is 1 nanomolar is about 1 molecule per cell. So yeah, this is amount. This is amount rather than concentration. So concentration would be continuous. Is that what you're... Yeah. Yeah, concentration is a continuous variable, whereas amount is discontinuous. The reason we do amount here... Yeah, we plotted this in lots of different ways. this is kind of what we decided was the clearest, although you may disagree, but yeah. Yeah, and in fact, you can see that our accuracy gets bad in a way because we don't think there's any degradation going on here, but it does become hard to measure these things, and so there's relatively more error at these low steps. So the technique's not perfect, but you can get a surprise. I guess the message I want to get across is you can get a surprising amount of data out of this, and we were kind of surprised. And we feel like we're starting to get a feeling for what it means to be a promoter operating inside the cell. You know, You're a little intrinsically noisy. You're feeling this slowly undulating variation from the overall cellular contents. And in addition, you're being duplicated on the cell cycle timescale. And these three things together give you your complete operational characteristic. And that those fluctuations add to the average, your average biochemical characteristics. Which you also knew. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So we think there's still a 5% intrinsic noise, which might be just this sort of replication stochasticity. And that, of course, won't go away at high expression level. But all the transcriptional noise does. And, of course, the dominant, what we think is that the dominant source of noise transcription of noise is transcription. In other words, it's the idea that at low transcription rates, you're just occasionally producing a message. That message is translated into a burst of proteins. And so when you turn down the rate of transcription, you just see more shot noise. That's essentially all there is to it. I mean, at least that accounts for most of what we see. So translational noise, in order to see translational noise, at least in a simple model of gene expression, you have to make the translation efficiency lower than around 2 proteins per mRNA. So above that, it's more or less negligible. But Well, we chose, so that some of that is a little bit of an artifact of how we did this. We chose to use strong ribosome binding sites, which are probably 10s or 20 proteins per message. You could also use very weak ribosome binding sites, and then you might be able to see translational noise. So to do that experiment, you might take like a polycistronic message and put a CFP and a YFP on the same operon and ask about the variation with weak ribosome binding sites. The only trouble with that experiment is there could be lots of things that are in classical genetics, bacterial genetics literature, known as polarity effects, where the two locations on the message are not always equivalent. And this happened to me because I actually tried to do that experiment, and I was finding that one of them, for reasons I don't know, was being expressed far, far higher than the other one systematically. So the second gene was being expressed far higher than the first one. Not an effect I understand yet. We're the same, yeah. We were seeing, let's see, now I have to think back. Yeah, so we tried to make an operon basically with CFP gene and YFP gene, same ribosome binding site on each one, in the hope that we could see translational noise. And I think the problem is exactly the kinds of effects you're describing are probably what was happening. Now, I'm remembering actually that the second gene was more highly expressed than the first gene, which is the reverse of what you said, but I could be wrong. Yeah.
Then the translation apparatus didn't have an mRNA, frankly.
The two pieces are the
half-life, depending upon the kinds of rather nutrients that are developed and target sites that people might have, farming, etc.
So, is this the difference in the US that people the difference between CSP and YSP or something like that? Do you have to be in the
mRNA or something like that? Well, just two different sequences. Of mRNAs is enough to make a scientific effect. The stabilizer for the sonic mRNA is cleavage, and the two parts can have totally different effects.
Even if they're roughly the same sequence, like
where's
the, you know,
the same molecule,
and then
again, like... Right, but they're not going to be the same mRNA. They'll be different sequences, right? There's different mRNA sequences, right? That's enough. It's a complicated thing. You'd have to go look at all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. Well, we were satisfied that we could account for most of it anyway through transcription, and there's probably, it could become significant in certain situations, but, yeah. Anyway.